Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for June 19th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the role of Merkel cells in your sense of touch, narrowing in on the contribution of aerosols to climate change, and the prospects for a cure for cystic fibrosis. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about warp speed raindrops, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The light touch that it takes to distinguish coins in your pocket, feel the edges of keys on the piano, and tell fine silk from polyester all involve Merkel cells. The cells were first discovered in the late 1800s, and previously scientists knew these cells were associated with this sense of light touch. But in a paper in this week's Science, Ellen Lumpkin, Huda Zoghbi, and colleagues have shown that Merkel cells are indeed essential for these kinds of light touch responses. They did it by conditionally deleting the ATO1 transcription factor from the body skin and foot pads of mice, which resulted in the complete loss of the characteristic neurophysiologic responses normally mediated by Merkel cell neurite complexes. I spoke with Lumpkin and Zoghbi from Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. Here's Ellen Lumpkin.
What we did in this paper was remove a transcription factor that's required for the development of a distinct subset of cells. And by doing so, we were able to prevent the development of Merkel cells so that we could ask a question that's been open for 135 years, which is the Merkel cell important for touch reception? And we were able to show that the Merkel cell is required for proper encoding of light touch.
Ellen, why has it taken such a long time to figure out the purpose of Merkel cells?
Well, people have been trying to do this experiment. Scientists have been trying to do this experiment for a few decades. And the problem has been that there hasn't been a method to cleanly take Merkel cells away but leave the nerve intact. And that's what we've been able to do in this study. So we have more tools available, genetic tools, that allow us to take the Merkel cell out of the system.
So Huda, this next question then is for you. How would you experience the world differently if you didn't have any Merkel cells?
Well, if you didn't have Merkel cells, there would be so many things that we take for granted in everyday life that we will not be able to experience, whether feeling the texture on material or typing on a computer and knowing you're actually hitting the key or playing the piano and feeling the curvature of the keys and the edges of the keys, to feeling the different coins when you put your hand in the purse. Almost everything you do in your daily life, you're actually using your fingertips to discriminate the texture, the shape, and the fine detail on any object you touch. And of course, Braille, reading Braille would not have been possible if we did not have Merkel cells.
Did the mice that you were able to generate, which lacked Merkel cells, behave differently?
These mice actually had some behavioral changes, but we have to go through detailed analysis to determine what's behind these behavioral changes. Because besides taking out Merkel cells, we've taken out some additional cells centrally, so one has to discern what component of that is due to the Merkel cells and what's not. So these are studies for the future.
As Huda just mentioned,
Ellen,
there are some cells in the spinal cord and in the brainstem that depend on the gene ATO1. So those neurons were also missing. This is what makes the behavioral experiments difficult to interpret in these mice. In the cutaneous skin, so in the peripheral nervous system, the only part of the system that we took out was the Merkel cell itself. And even the nerve that sends information from the Merkel cell to the central nervous system was still maintained in these mice. So the way that we were able to look for a specific touch deficit is by using a preparation where we can record the neural impulses from the sensory neurons that specifically innervate the skin. And when we did that experiment, what we found is that the other kinds of light touch receptors and pain receptors were found in the skin with normal abundance. But the kinds of nerves that hook up to the Merkel cell were missing. or the responses from those nerves were missing.
So all the other nerves were there for sensing temperature or pain, but they didn't respond in the same way.
In this study, we didn't actually test specifically for neural responses for temperature, but when we look by staining experiments, we see that the free nerve endings that are thought to encode temperature are there and look perfectly normal. The ones that are there for sensing painful touch did respond in a normal way, and that's what we would expect because we know that those nerves do not hook up to Merkel cells. But the nerves that are responsible for our sense of fine touch and our ability to resolve fine spatial details were specifically missing. And we can tell those responses because they have a really characteristic irregular firing pattern. They sound like a popcorn popper, like this. When you play their responses through a speaker, which is the way we do the experiments. And we can tell those responses apart from other light touch receptors that sound like this. So we could easily tell those kinds of neurons apart from other light touch receptors.
Huda, what else does this ATO1 gene do?
Well, ATO1 is quite an interesting gene because it turns out it does many, many things. But as I walk you through them, you're going to find that they are actually somehow related. So ATO1 makes the inner ear hair cells. These are the tiny hair cells inside the cochlea and the vestibular system. These are the cells that allow you to hear and allow you to know the position of your head once you move your head, you know, in many different directions. And of course, this is important for balance. But in addition to that, ATO1 make many neurons of what we call the proprioceptive system. What is the proprioceptive system? It's the system that allows you to know your position in space. When you get up in the middle of the night to walk to get a drink of water, you can actually walk through the room, get to the sink, fill up the cup all in the dark, and know exactly where to put your hand and how, where to put your feet, all of that without really conscious intervention. It's an unconscious sort of sense of walking around and knowing that, and that requires many neurons, and many of those neurons are dependent on ATO1. You need this gene for these neurons to develop normally. It also makes up neurons in the cerebellum, which is an important station for where that proprioceptive sense is coming. In addition to that, ATO makes the secretory cells in the intestine. These are the cells that makes all these neuroendocrine peptides like serotonin and many others. There's many different kinds. Also the cells that make the mucus in the intestine and the colon, as well as cells that makes the antimicrobial peptides. So every important cell that's secretory in the intestine depends on ATO1. So these are some of the few cells, and we're now continuing work, and we're discovering it's actually important for additional cells, and this is work that's currently in progress, and hopefully you'll get to hear about it soon. So it's quite an important gene, and of course now we know it's very important for these light touch receptors.
So next steps then, Ellen, are to piece apart the specific function of Merkel cells as compared to the neurons they connect with?
Absolutely. This is the question that I'm most interested in right now. So our data show that Merkel cells are required for the appropriate light touch response of this particular type of light touch receptor. And the next question is the Merkel cell actually the force-sensitive cell that converts the energy of the touch into an electrical signal that gets propagated to the brain? That's the way the hair cells that Huda just mentioned work, that are also ATO-dependent. The other possibility is that the nerve itself is the touch receptor and that the Merkel cell is somehow required for the specific neural code that this light touch receptor sends to the brain. And we're working on experiments now to piece that apart.
Ellen Lumpkin and Huda Zoghbi, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert.
You are most welcome.
Ellen Lumpkin and Huda Zoghbi of Baylor College of Medicine are corresponding authors of a paper on how Merkel cells are essential for light touch responses. Last week, Congress passed a bill authorizing the Food and Drug Administration to regulate tobacco products in the United States. Here with more about it is Science's Policy Forum editor, Brad Weibel.
The FDA will now have the authority to ban some of the chemicals in tobacco products and to set other product standards. To do this, the FDA will establish a tobacco regulatory office that will be financed by millions in industry fees. According to one government source, this new office, which will include a scientific advisory panel on tobacco-related issues, will eventually hire hundreds of scientists. The passage of this bill capped a years-long effort by public health advocates and some members of Congress. This version closely follows a 2007 report by the Institute of Medicine that called for FDA to have such regulatory authority. Yet critics of the bill say it defies logic to put a product that kills hundreds of thousands of Americans annually under the jurisdiction of the FDA, a public health agency. That argument didn't resonate with a wide majority of members of Congress. President Obama, who has promised to sign the bill into law, said in a statement that this bill will make history by giving the scientists and medical experts at the FDA the power to take sensible steps that will reduce tobacco's harmful effects and prevent tobacco companies from marketing their products to children.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. The processes behind climate change are numerous and complex. For instance, the direct effect of aerosols in the atmosphere, depending on what they're made of, can have either a warming or a cooling effect on the climate. And according to the fourth assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, the overall effect is a cooling. That's called a negative radiative forcing, and the IPCC puts it at negative 0.5 watts per square meter. To put that in perspective, that cooling from the direct aerosol effect offsets the warming from the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide by almost a third. But in a paper published online by Science, Gunamira reports that the cooling from the direct effect of aerosols is not as strong as that and is only about negative 0.3 watts per square meter, or about 40% less. The discrepancy is because the relative increase in black carbon aerosols, which absorb energy and heat the atmosphere, is much larger than the overall increase in the abundance of aerosols caused by human activity. I spoke with Mira from his office at the Center for International Climate and Environmental Research in Oslo, Norway.
This paper quantifies to a much better extent and gives a better understanding of the climate effect of the direct aerosol effect. The direct aerosol effect is scattering and absorption by small particles in the atmosphere. And the direct aerosol effect is, among a few other mechanisms, how humans have altered the climate. And the aerosols in general had a cooling effect on the climate. And so the human activity has masked some of the warming from the greenhouse gases. And unlike the greenhouse gases, the climate effect of the aerosol have been quite uncertain. And to really understand how human impacted the climate so far, it's really important to understand the climate effect of the aerosols. And thus, the direct aerosol effect is one of the key mechanisms here.
What's the current consensus of the contribution of the direct aerosol effect on climate change?
The general consensus is that the net effect is a cooling effect. But earlier, we had estimates from two different methods. One is from based on observations that in general has stronger cooling effect than from global aerosol models. This paper shows that the cooling effect from the observational-based method do not take into account in a proper way absorption. Absorbing particles have increased a lot more than the aerosol amount over the industrial period.
Before we get to that, what aerosols are being modeled, and of those, which ones are we putting up into the air that are having the greatest effect on climate change?
The main aerosol types in the atmosphere is mineral dust, sea salt, sulfate, and black carbon, and organic carbon, and nitrate. Of those, human activity impact sulfate, black carbon, and organic carbon, and nitrate. And these are the components that we take into account in our study.
So what new data or models or assumptions then led to the consistency you found between the observations and the model estimates?
Yeah, we had our model and those results have been published earlier. And a new thing we derived here was a new observational based method, and we looked more carefully into the differences. And what I then found that in the observational method, to get consistency between the model and observational based method, we could see that the change over the industrial period with a strong increase in black carbon content compared to other aerosol effect, that was not possible to derive in the observational based method without doing an adjustment for that, similar to what we do in the model. So our main outcome is also that it's not possible with a pure observational based method to calculate the climate effect of the observational based method.
So more black carbon is the main reason for the difference between the observational based estimate and the model estimates?
Yes, and when we look at the emissions, we can clearly see that the emissions of black carbon has increased relatively much more than the emissions of other species, even also those species that has large anthropogenic changes. And there's also some aerosol types where we have no or very small human impact on, like mineral dust and also sea salt that is a pure natural compound.
What's then your estimate, and how does it compare with the previous estimate and consensus from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC?
Yeah, our new estimate is within the range that's given in the IPCC, but it's weaker than the best estimate from IPCC. The best estimate from IPCC is minus 0.5 watt per square meter, but a rather large range from minus 0.1 to minus 0.9. In the new estimate, I reduced the uncertainty range by a factor of 2. So I have an uncertainty range with upper range, the same as before, from minus 0.1, and a new lower bound of minus 0.5 watt per square meter, and the best estimate of minus 0.3 watt per square meter.
How might that uncertainty be further reduced?
To really reduce this uncertainty, I think we must really understand the differences among the different global aerosol models. And that we have somewhere between 15 and 20 global aerosol models at the moment. And it's no ongoing research to set up new simulation by these models. And that will be ready for before the next IPCC report. And differences between these models and to understand the differences among these will be a key issue. Also, the main cause of differences between the various models will probably be associated with the absorbing aerosol, the black carbon, and particularly how the vertical distribution of these particles and their relation to the vertical layer of clouds. That's a likely reason for the differences we see between models, but also there's also a lot of other issues that can cause differences between models.
Gunamira, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gunamira of the Center for International Climate and Environmental Research writes on the consistency between satellite-derived and modeled estimates of the direct aerosol effect. Find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. In 1989, scientists cloned the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator, or cystic fibrosis gene. Shortly thereafter, researchers expected that they would soon have the cure to cystic fibrosis in patients because they had managed to cure the deadly disease in the test tube through gene therapy, and the gene transfer techniques required for gene therapy in people had been demonstrated to be feasible by researchers at the National Institutes of Health. But as Science News writer Jennifer Cousin-Frankel reports in this week's issue, 20 years have now passed, and the cure for cystic fibrosis is still just around the corner. I spoke with Cousin-Frankel from her home office in Philadelphia.
The lesson that I took away from this story is that it's really, really tough to translate genetic knowledge into something that is tangible for patients with that disease. So when the gene for cystic fibrosis was found back in 1989, there was tremendous hope that that meant the disease would soon be cured. And while certainly things have improved for people who have the disease, much of that has not been due directly to the gene, although now there are some things that are going on that may change that.
What further knowledge have scientists learned about the genetic underpinnings of cystic fibrosis in the 20 years since cloning the mutated gene associated with it?
Well, having the gene in hand has really allowed them to understand the pathology of the disease a whole lot better. What's going on? Why things are going wrong? Why having, there's one very common mutation and then there are a number of rare mutations. Why having these mutations in the CF gene can cause all the problems associated with CF, like lung infections, mucus in the lungs, digestive problems, particularly regarding the pancreas, and other complications. So they understand the disease itself much, much better than they did before. And everyone agrees that if they hadn't found the gene, they'd really still be, you know, in the dark trying to guess at what was happening in patients with CF.
What have been some of the major attempts to convert the genetic knowledge into treatment?
Well, one is certainly new animal models, which can really make a big difference both in terms of testing treatments and also in terms of just understanding what's going on with the biology of the disease. So there was certainly a very early effort to develop a mouse model that was somewhat disappointing because the mice didn't really mimic the lung disease that children with CF and young adults with CF develop. But more recently, there's a pig model, and even more recently than that, a ferret model that people are much more hopeful about. So that's something that has happened. Another major effort was gene therapy, which was at the time the CF gene was found was sort of the obvious strategy that people looked to cure the disease. Let's just take the good gene and give it to people who don't have the good gene. Their cells will pick that up and they won't have CF anymore. And that made a whole lot of sense, but it turned out to be a lot more difficult than people thought. And while there are still gene therapy efforts going on, to some degree, the field has moved away from that and towards more traditional drugs, also based on genetic information.
Are any of those drugs out on the market yet?
No, they are not on the market. There are two drugs by a company called Vertex Pharmaceuticals that are in trials, in clinical trials now, so they're being tested in people with CF. And a lot of patients, families, and researchers are very hopeful about these drugs, and they are based very specifically on what is going wrong with the CF protein. There are a number of different defects that come up with the CF protein, and these drugs are kind of going after a couple of those. So there's hope that those will be very helpful, but we don't have all the information yet because they're still being tested.
Now, you said that researchers have sort of moved on from gene therapy, but that it hasn't entirely stopped. What new directions are scientists looking at?
Well, in terms of gene therapy, the U.S. researchers have largely moved on from doing, so certainly gene therapy is still active, but cystic fibrosis gene therapy in the U.S. is not so active anymore, and that kind of faded about 10 years ago in the late 90s or so. But in the U.K., there's actually a big, big effort to do gene therapy, and they have a slightly different strategy than was taken by many groups in the U.S., that they hope may be more effective, and that they are launching actually quite a big clinical trial in the UK now to give gene therapy to people with CF and are hopeful that it will work. And I think the tension here is that gene therapy, if it works, in some ways can be preferable to a drug, researchers say, because you're just correcting everything. So if you have a protein that has 20 different things wrong with it, a drug can only fix one or two of those at a time, so you need a lot of different drugs if you're trying to get at a lot of different defects. But gene therapy, if it works, can fix everything. So that's why I think there is still hope that if we can get gene therapy to work, that would be wonderful. But in the U.S., a lot of researchers aren't thinking that that's a really strong possibility.
Since the discovery 20 years ago, what's been the outcome for patients? How has that changed?
Well, for patients, the outcome has actually changed quite a bit, and things have certainly gotten better. The median life expectancy was in the high 20s when the gene was discovered back in 89, and now it's roughly in the high 30s. So they're certainly doing better, and there's much more of an effort to treat patients earlier, to treat patients more aggressively before they really develop overt severe disease, so to kind of prevent disease before it happens, particularly in the lungs. And that has really made a difference. So there are a lot of young adults out there now and even middle-aged adults with CF, many more than there used to be. But what's interesting is that a lot of those advances are really not directly connected to the discovery of the gene. So the gene has done a lot for the field, but if you're someone with CF, the gene is not necessarily the reason why you now have a really good shot at living longer than you used to. There's hope that that is going to change and that the new treatments that are just in the pipeline now that are connected to the genetic knowledge will also make a big difference in terms of life expectancy. But the current improvements in life expectancy are not a direct result of finding the gene 20 years ago.
So are there any diseases in which a gene has been found that is closely associated with the development of the disease in which there's now a genetic-based therapy?
I think there are certainly diseases that have progressed more quickly than CF in terms of finding therapies that are based on that genetic knowledge, although I think some of those are really also still in testing and not necessarily, you know, a quote-unquote cure for the disease. One thing that I found from this story is that, you know, 20 years is a fairly long time in science, and it's long enough to really see what's happened to a field. And while the CF gene has made a huge difference to the CF field, it has taken this long for us to now get to some drugs that may, you know, potentially help the disease and that are also based on that genetic knowledge. So I think that says that we should keep in mind as we find all these other genes for all these other diseases, particularly these more genetically complex diseases like heart disease, that taking that genetic information and turning it into something like a treatment can be really, really slow going.
Jennifer Cousin-Frankel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science news writer Jennifer Cousin-Frankel reports on the latest in cystic fibrosis research and treatment. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story on warp speed raindrops. Dave, warp speed, at least as far as my Star Trek knowledge goes, is faster than the speed of light. These aren't really warp speed raindrops.
Right, Rob. These drops aren't actually traveling faster than the speed of light. But what they are doing is these smaller raindrops are traveling much faster than they should be. They're breaking what physicists thought was their speed limit. And the way this works is, if you can imagine a rainstorm, you've got your big drops and you've got your small drops. And because of wind resistance, these drops actually fall at different rates. And in fact, the big drops fall faster, just as a chair thrown out of an office building is going to fall faster to the ground than a feather thrown out of a window. So if there was no air, so say there was a rainstorm on the moon, these drops would fall at the same rate. But because of the influence of air resistance, we do have these larger drops falling faster. But that's not what scientists have actually seen. When researchers have gone out and measured raindrops, they've sometimes seen these small raindrops falling as fast as the large ones, which shouldn't be possible. So this new study is all about figuring out, well, how does this happen?
So why is it, Dave?
Well, Rob, it turns out that when you have these big rainstorms, these big drops can shatter midair, and that could be because they crash into other big raindrops. But what happens is you've got these big raindrops falling at their speed, which is a very fast speed compared to the small raindrops. And all of a sudden, they break apart into these smaller raindrops. And for those few moments that that happens, because a lot of times this will happen right before the drops hit the ground, those smaller raindrops are actually traveling at the same speed that the big drops were, because they've sort of taken that velocity from the larger raindrops. And they may start to slow down a little bit, but usually by the time they hit the ground, they're traveling a lot faster than they should be otherwise. So you can imagine maybe that chair thrown out of an office building, if there's a feather taped to the chair, and right before the chair hits the ground, the feather becomes detached, that feather's probably going to hit the ground at a much faster speed than it would otherwise.
So this phenomenon of the smaller raindrops traveling just as fast as the larger raindrops is because of the instant that the scientists are measuring the smaller raindrops close to the ground when they've just broken apart from being big raindrops.
Exactly. And actually, this study, apart from being kind of neat, has some practical implications as well. A lot of times when researchers are measuring the amount of rain that's hitting the ground, they're not looking at the actual number of raindrops. They're looking at the speed of raindrops hitting the ground. So they're saying, well, there's a lot of raindrops hitting the ground really fast, so there must be a lot of rain. But if it turns out that a lot of those raindrops are actually small raindrops that are hitting the ground, then there may not be as much rain hitting the ground as meteorologists think there is. And so this could have implications for not only telling us about the weather we're experiencing right now, but potentially even forecasting future weather patterns.
Okay, so what other stories have you got with you today?
Well, Rob, speaking of water hitting the earth, how about water as is important for life? And this next story has to do with the so-called habitable zone. And this is what astronomers look for when they're looking at all these extrasolar planets that are out there, and we found a few hundred of them so far. And obviously, one of the very first questions they ask themselves is, once they find these planets, is this a planet capable of supporting life? And right now, they have a very narrow definition of how they define whether a world can support life. What they're looking for is hints that that world could have liquid water on it.
So the zone is not too far away from the sun and not too close.
Right. You can think of it sort of like Goldilocks. If the planet has to be just far enough from the sun, if it's too close and it has any water, all that water is going to be gas in the atmosphere. And if it's too far away, all that water is going to be ice. But it turns out, according to this new study, that astronomers should really be adding another criterion into the mix. And this criterion has everything to do with volcanoes. And it turns out that volcanoes are actually really important for life. Even on Earth, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for volcanoes. The volcanoes that were present on a very early and very geologically active Earth were spewing a lot of carbon dioxide and also water vapor into the atmosphere from deep within the Earth. And carbon dioxide became very important because it helped form our atmosphere, but it also was an important gas for the first photosynthesizers on Earth. And obviously this water was very important because we all need water to live.
But I imagine just like the Goldilocks situation, right? Too much volcanism could be bad too.
Exactly. Too much volcanism is bad. And we see that on one of Jupiter's moons, Io, which has a lot of what geologists call tidal forces. And these are caused by Jupiter and other moons basically pulling on this moon. And these forces create a lot of volcanism on the surface of Io, which causes basically the planet to be coated in lava every million years or so. And you can imagine that's not very good for life. But on the opposite end of the spectrum, we have Mars, which doesn't have a lot of tidal forces on it and isn't very volcanically active. And because of that, it's a dead world.
So the tidal forces are acting on the magma as opposed to water, like we think of it here. And that pulling of the magma, or the pulling of the lava, is sort of what causes the volcano to occur.
Yeah, they're basically causing a lot of, these tidal forces are basically causing a lot of geological instability, which is causing these eruptions.
So in looking at other planets, planets outside of our solar system, and seeing whether or not they're habitable, what else will scientists be looking for then in terms of these tidal forces?
Well, in this study, they actually have an interesting test case. It's an extrasolar planet called GJ581D, and none of these extrasolar planets have very friendly names, but that's this one's name. It's about 20 light years away, and theoretically, it seems like it should be habitable, potentially, because it's a rocky planet like Earth, and it's just far enough away from its sun that there could potentially be liquid water on the surface. But when these researchers looked at the tidal forces on the planet, they saw that there wasn't very much tidal force being exerted on GJ581D. And that means it's probably a world more like Mars. It's not very geologically active, and therefore it may not be spewing CO2 or water vapor into the atmosphere like Earth did, and because of that, wouldn't be a good candidate for life.
So another litmus test, basically.
Another litmus test for life in extrasolar planets.
Okay, and last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, speaking of how life came to be, this last story is about evolution in action. And it's always nice, we talk so much about evolution and biology, it's always nice to see these little snapshots of actually researchers seeing what they think is evolution actually occurring on timescales that we can measure. And this study has to do with flycatcher birds. And these are these small birds. The birds in this study live on the Solomon Islands in the South Pacific. And a famous biologist, Ernst Mayr, in the 1940s, noticed that the flycatchers on these islands seem to have started to speciate. In other words, even though there was one species of flycatcher on all of these islands, there were about five different subtypes that looked like they were sort of deviating from each other. And in fact, there's two different birds that live on islands that are about 10 kilometers apart from each other. And one is an all-black bird or an all-blue-black bird. And the other one is only black on its back, and its belly is sort of a brown chestnut color. And you can see pictures of these birds on the site.
And so these are both flycatchers, but they're on their way to becoming different species.
Well, that was the question in this study. You know, these birds look different. They don't seem to be different species yet, but are they on the road to becoming different species? And what the researchers did was they focused on the color because that was the most salient difference between these two birds. And they homed in on a gene for something called the melanocortin 1 receptor. And this is a protein that researchers already know in sheep and pigs controls how black these animals are. And they wondered if the same gene was responsible for the different patterns of blackness in these two birds. And indeed, they found that there was a very small change. In fact, a change that caused a single amino acid to be different in this receptor between the brown-chested birds and the black-chested birds. And this single change was all that was needed to change the bird's chest black. So now the researchers had a genetic basis for this divergence between these two types of birds. But in order for speciation to happen, you can't just have a genetic difference. You actually have to have a difference that's going to cause these birds to stop mating with each other and eventually be able to not mate with each other at all, and thereby fulfill the definition of what it means to be a different species.
So they did some sort of behavioral study next?
They did. And what they did was they took stuffed flycatchers, one that was all black and one that had a brown chest, and they put them in the territories of each of these birds. And what the researchers found is that the birds attacked the birds, the stuffed birds that looked the same as them, and ignored the birds that looked different from them. And what researchers know about territorial birds, like these flycatchers, is that the same cues that tell them, you know, whether to attack the same kind of bird also tell them which mates to choose. So even though these researchers haven't quite yet shown that these color differences lead to mating differences, they've at least identified a similar behavior which could cause the different colored birds to stop mating with each other, which would lead to speciation down the line.
So we're seeing a snapshot here along the path of a speciation event. Is that how it's being received by other scientists?
Yeah, and scientists are excited about this, although they caution that because the team actually hasn't seen definitive behavioral differences, especially in terms of mating yet, they can't conclude that speciation is actually happening here, even though it looks like it is.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about tracking penguins with their poop. And actually, this week, we have a story about tracking tigers with their poop. And it's a bit of a different strategy, but it's really important for tiger conservation in the wild. So be sure to check out that one.
They're not using satellite data, then.
They're not using satellite data. And we've also got a story about the mystery of sunspots. And on the policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking into what role Obama is playing in climate change policy, and also how U.S. students are faring in math compared to the rest of the world. Turns out not very well. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the June 19th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.